From PCJ Radio International, welcome to Focus Asia Pacific. I'm Keith Parent. As the center of Bangkok grinds to a halt, the flow on effect could be significant, even though the military says it won't interfere. A resolution is nowhere in sight, with Prime Mayor Yuktin Shinawatra vowing to protect democracy and the protesters wanting to bring down her government. They are claiming that her brother Thaksin, the ousted prime minister and now in exile, is continuing to influence the running of the nation. The government has offered to postpone next month's polls, but that seems unlikely to end Bangkok's showdown. For more, here's Samantha Hawley from Bangkok.
This is day three of Bangkok's occupation, and this is the sound that rings out day and night. In their thousands, they make sure normality cannot return to the centre of this bustling metropolis. While only small pockets of violence have erupted, the concern is the longer these protesters stay, the greater the chance of history repeating itself. In 2010, the Red Shirts, or supporters of the former leader Thaksin Shinawatra, staged similar mass rallies. More than 90 people were killed.
All we need is a hothead from one side or the other to start causing a problem, and we're off to the races.
Human Rights Watch Deputy Director in Asia, Philip Robertson, has been watching the protest closely.
And I think right now the protests are in a bit of a honeymoon period. Bangkok is trying it on for size. They're taking a look at it. People are adjusting their routines to deal with the protests. But after a week or two, then we might see tempers getting a little more frayed.
The Prime Minister, Yingluck Shinawatra, will today hold talks to consider delaying the very election she called for February the 2nd in a bid to halt the unrest. But no one of significance in this fight will show up. The opposition, the protest group, and not even the Electoral Commission are willing to attend. Titanan Ponsadurak is the director of the Institute of Security at the Chulalongkorn University in Bangkok.
The costs will rise and the grievances will mount and it will become unbearable and untenable and someone will do something. I think that something will give.
What could it be, do you think?
In the past, we've had a number of military coups in Thailand. The military question mark around the military about what they want to do next. We have a number of watchdog agencies that have been assertive in the past, so they could step in. The Prime Minister could resign, despite the signs to the contrary.
Philip Robertson from Human Rights Watch again.
If, for instance, there was a coup d'etat that they could mobilise very easily.
And what are the chances, in your view, of a coup?
The military commander says he's not going to do it. He doesn't want to be asked about it, so... unclear.
There have been 18 coups since the 1930s in Thailand. So far, the military chief here has ruled out staging the 19th.
And that was Samantha Hawley reporting from Bangkok, Thailand. Myanmar's military has been again accused of using rape as a weapon of war in the country's ethnic regions. A report by the Thai-based Women's League of Burma says it's documented more than 100 cases since the 2010 civilian elections. Myanmar has denied its military is using rape as a means of war, with presidential spokesmen saying if soldiers committed rape, effective action would be taken against them. However, the WLB says the military culture of impunity has not changed. The WLB based its report on incidents documented by the Kachin Women's Association Thailand, the Shan Women's Action Network, the Karen Women's Organization, and the Karen Human Rights Group. Sen Lam speaks next to Nawa Kushan, the Joint Secretary of the Women's League of Burma.
In this report, we gather the information collected by our member organization, which focuses on the sexual violence by the army since the 2010 election. We documented 104 women have been subjected to the sexual violence by the Burma army. And the cases involve 59 women in Kachin State, 35 women in Shan State, and 9 women in Karen State. So most of the cases are linked to the military offensive in Kachin and Northern Shan State in 2011. The incident took place nearly in every ethnic areas where the conflict is taking place. Like, for example, it took place in Kachin State where the offensive is going on, and it took place in Karen State. This is only 3 areas that we cover so far, but we still have other areas, like we didn't receive the information. So in this report, we can get only 104 cases from the three states.
So is the violence mainly perpetrated against tribal groups in remote parts of Myanmar?
We can see that the sexual violence is happening like not only in one area. It is nationwide, mostly in the ethnic areas where the armed conflict is taking place. And also the soldiers who rape women, they will not get any punishment and they continue to do it with the impunity, including their military. You can see that in our report. Most of the cases are also committed by the military top officer. So this is why there is no punishment for those who rape women, and the system of impunity still continue, even the new government is taking over.
So you're saying that these incidents are not isolated or random ones, that there is a culture of rape in the Myanmar military where soldiers act with impunity?
Yes, because the soldier who rape women never get the punishment and they continue to do it with impunity, even though after election and the new government is taking over. 10 years ago, we released a report named System of Impunity, a report about sexual crimes committed by the Burma Army in ethnic areas. And we call for an end to the system of impunity. But again today, we want to point out that sexual violence still happening in Burma under the new government since 2010 election. So the same thing still continue. We don't see much change because the women of Burma continue suffering under this government.
And your report says the Myanmar military is still using rape as a weapon of war. Can you explain that, please?
Yes, because when women are raped, they are also isolated in the community. There is a stigma. The women, after they were raped, they become mentally traumatized. And there is a look down in the community. It's not in one area, like in one state. It happened mostly in different ethnic areas. So they try to terrorize, intimidate women so that the women will not be able to support, the ethnic armed groups. From our documentation, we also found that women have been raped because they are accused of being supporter of the armed groups. This is why they are using this to terrorize and intimidate the ethnic women. And they are using it mostly in the conflict areas.
The Myanmar military has responded to your report. It says that it's not official policy of the Tatmadaw, the Burmese military, to use rape as a means of war, and that if there are any rape cases, they should be reported and the military will take effective action. As far as you know, is that accurate?
Our organization and member organization have been published more than 5 reports on the sexual violence, and also when we went to the UN, we also give the information to the UN, and there is no investigation have been made. The military officer themselves also raped the women, which encouraged their soldier also to do the same thing.
What would you like the international community to do?
To establish the genuine democracy in Burma, and the government has to acknowledge responsibility for the past human rights abuses to end the long suffering of the women of Burma. And also the judicial independence has to be guaranteed by the constitution, and the judicial system need to be reformed until the military is placed under civilian control through constitutional amendments. This kind of sexual abuses against ethnic women will not stop. This is why we would like to request the international community also to pressure their governments to review their engagement with the military regime. At the same time, also continue support those who are doing this kind of work and continue fighting for their rights.
Noah Kushi, the Joint Secretary of the Women's League of Burma, speaking with Sen Lam. China's long-running campaign against corruption is showing early signs of progress. 18 provincial-level officials were recently purged for corruption, and President Xi Jinping has called on China's political and legal institutions to improve their law enforcement capabilities. The Chinese leader may be going hard against corruption, but does he run the risk of alienating the nation's ruling elite? Kandahar Sapati has more.
When Xi Jinping took over the top post as president of China in 2012, he made the crackdown on official corruption one of his top priorities. Public anger against official corruption has been on the rise, and while President Xi sees the need to address the problem, his dilemma is to what extent can he crack down on graft without alienating and dividing the ruling elite? Professor David Zweig from the Hong Kong University of Science and Technology is confident that the party will back him.
There's a very strong support for this because the case can be easily made that without this kind of campaign, the party is going to dissolve, it's going to fall apart, it's going to crumble. And so I think people recognize that. He also got the authority at the 18th Party Congress. It's important to remember that at the 18th Party Congress, they agreed that that could be one of the main tasks of the next 5 years.
Within the last year, 18 provincial-level officials have been purged. The only prominent casualty of the anti-corruption campaign so far has been the disgraced former secretary of the Chongqing Chinese Communist Party, Bo Jilai. The litmus test for the president now is whether his government will prosecute Yeo Yong-kang, a former member of the Politburo Standing Committee. Last week, President Xi told the National Political and Legal Work Conference that efforts must be made to reform China's legal system, fight judicial corruption, and improve law enforcement capabilities. Currently, the Communist Party's powerful anti-corruption unit, the Central Commission for Discipline Inspection, or CDIC, is responsible for targeting corrupt officials. But Dr. Bo Che-ye, Senior Research Fellow at the Institute of East Asian Studies at the National University of Singapore, says the lack of independent mechanisms to tackle corruption has its problems.
The concern is that if you don't have institutionalized mechanisms against corruption, then, you know, I think the campaign itself can become a tool of a power struggle. Because you can pick and choose whoever you wanted to label as a corrupt official and protect those corrupt officials because they are close to you. So people are concerned that this is not a real anti-corruption campaign. It could be a power struggle.
There is no clear definition as to what equates to corruption. Does it mean activities of just the official, or should it include family and friends who have benefited from his or her position? Dr. Bo again.
A lot of officials, corrupt officials, are using their families as a shield for their own names. So corruption is not a corruption of the one particular person.
There are some 300 to 400 wealthy families in China who, it's alleged, have amassed their wealth through the high offices of their relatives, including the family of former Prime Minister Wen Jiabao. Much of the information into the corrupt activities of families of high officials have come from the public and media. Yet, despite his promise to fight corruption, President Xi is not willing to allow or seek public support in his campaign. Professor Zweig.
Xi Jinping is not a Democrat. Xi Jinping is very cautious about limiting the role of the media and Weibo, the internet, for all this.
In fact, President Xi has come down strong on bloggers and the social media. Dr. Bo says while the president has a legitimate concern about unimpeded public involvement in the anti-corruption drive, the public voice should not be suppressed.
Using disciplinary mechanisms is okay, but you should also allow the people to come forth to help with the information to do a better job at rooting out the corruption in China.
Kedahar Sapati reporting. Staying on China, economists say China's growth could and should be halved. That's an update that was made January the 14th. Expectations that China will continue to grow its economy at 7% or more are too optimistic. They say that growth rates may fall as low as 3 and 4%, which means much-needed economic reforms are beginning to work. But that forecast will strike fear into the boardrooms of many of Australia's resource companies, which is, of course, one of China's biggest exporters, which have enjoyed for years booming exports to feed China's rapid industrialization. Karen Snowden has the story.
Australia's mining companies and its national accounts have done very well out of China's rapid growth. And that's continuing, even though it's slowed to around 7.5% from the 10 to 12% of the past 2 to 3 decades. Forecasters say iron ore sales alone for this year will earn Australia between $80 to $100 billion. But if China's growth rate falls to 3 or 4%, that's a different story.
Exactly right. China consumes something like 60% of total global iron ore. So an adjustment in China almost certainly will mean a significant reduction in the price of hard commodities, which affects countries like Australia, Brazil, Peru, etc.
There's nothing magical about a 7% growth rate. It's what China's leaders want. And it's what many analysts believe is the rate at which the economy can more sustainably expand and still provide jobs. Policies are now focused on that goal. The shift is to encourage more domestic consumption and control the excessive reliance on real estate speculation and massive infrastructure building and their massive debts, which have grown at two or three times the rate of the economy.
Slowing down debt creation will slow down growth pretty significantly. In fact, interest rates have to go up, the currency has to continue to rise, and wages have to rise more quickly than productivity for a few years. This will rebalance the economy, but in the same way that it goosed GDP growth for the last 20 to 30 years, reversing it will have a negative impact. So almost by definition, the reforms must result in much slower, although much healthier growth.
The adjustment process will be painful. Rebalancing means addressing the large gaps that have opened between the extremely rich political and economic elites and the majority of less well-off. Michael Pettis says if financial reform is implemented, growth must fall. In his view, lower growth will benefit ordinary households because, put simply, they will gain a bigger share of national income. But he adds Beijing's efforts at reform might not succeed.
We are likely to see substantial political opposition to the reforms. Not only have we already seen that in China, the last 2 to 3 years have been pretty, let's say, exciting in terms of politics at the elite level, but also this is what we've seen in every other country that's gone through this adjustment process.
And if that growth model is imposed and growth rates are lower, how low are you saying it might fall, and how serious will that be?
Well, in my opinion, a best-case scenario suggests that the upper limit of growth on average during the 10-year expected presidency of President Xi Jinping is probably not going to exceed 3 to 4%.
But that's shockingly low for most watchers of China, surely?
Yes. The beginnings of the adjustment have lopped about 3 percentage points off growth, and we've only just begun the adjustment process. Now, if growth rates don't drop, I would consider that to be an indication that Beijing has had real trouble implementing the reforms.
So how China deals with these issues is, of course, of profound significance for China, but also for the rest of the world because of China's size now and importance in
sure.
the global economy. So if those 3 or 4% growth rates eventuate, is that good or bad for China and the global economy?
It depends on whether it happens in an orderly way, which I'm still betting that it will happen, or in a disorderly way. As far as the rest of the world goes, what we would want to see is an adjusting China in which Chinese imports grow more quickly than Chinese exports. Now, not positive for everybody, unfortunately.
And not Australia in the short term, certainly,
no.
as a resource exporter, perhaps.
Exactly right.
And if you've just tuned in, you're listening to Focus Asia Pacific, coming to you from PCJ Radio International. As concerns mount across the Asia-Pacific over the proposed 12-country regional trade and investment agreement, EU officials are worried that the deal will damage European interests in the region. Indeed, Asia policy experts in Brussels say the European Union may be sidelined by the U.S.-backed Trans-Pacific Partnership, or TPP. To get rid of those fears, Washington had sent the predominant Asian policy expert to the European Union. Daniel Russell has been meeting with EU officials, arguing that everyone would benefit from the TPP, including Europe. But not everyone is convinced. James Panici has the story.
It's a cold, rainy afternoon in the European Union precinct of Brussels, and the city's community of Asia watchers is descending on the plush residence palace. Journalists, academics and business lobby groups are here for Assistant Secretary Russell's take on the trade issue of the day. While the EU has been transfixed by negotiations leading to its own trade deal with the United States, European exporters are more concerned about how they'll be affected by the TPP, an agreement they're not part of. Mr. Russell, one of the architects of President Barack Obama's so-called policy pivot towards a greater engagement with Asia, wasted no time in reassuring his audience.
The short version of why I am here in Europe is that the U.S. is both an Atlantic and a Pacific country. And as important as our policies and strategy towards the Asia-Pacific region is, it's equally important that we move in consultation with and in tandem with our European partners. We have shared interests, and we should operate as the strategic partners that we are.
Yet there is little doubt that the US-led TPP, which would take in countries across the Pacific, including Australia, represents a serious threat to Europe's trade priorities in the region. The fear expressed by many here today is that the EU has allowed the US to gain a competitive edge. Gauri Kundekar from the European think tank FRIDE says while there are EU trade initiatives underway in Asia, they're likely to be trumped by the TPP.
There are a number of free trade initiatives ongoing with ASEAN countries, yet it's quite slow. Europe had begun a plurilateral region-to-region agreement with ASEAN, which it discontinued after 2 years in 2009. And then it began a whole round of bilateral initiatives, beginning with Singapore, but none have been concluded as yet. The only agreement, free trade agreement, that the EU has in Asia is with South Korea, and I think that is not enough.
Yet it's not all bad news for the European Union. If the US government signs the TPP alongside the proposed trade and investment agreement with the EU, that could make it easier for both deals to make it through Congress. What's more, if successful, the TPP could pave the way for similar EU-backed regional agreements. Andrew Small is from the Asia program of the Washington-based German Marshall Fund of the United States, an NGO.
The Korea deals, the two deals with the Koreans, the EU and the American one, were very mutually supportive. I think they slashed the amount of time that the European deal took close, possibly by even, you know, a couple of years. The Japanese are central to TPP and to an agreement that's being negotiated with the Europeans. So I think generally there's a mutually supportive framework. And ultimately, I mean, all of this stuff, the question is going to be, when does this get pulled back to the WTO? Is there a way of incorporating this under WTO auspices at some point? And I think both sides, and particularly the Europeans, will be keen to ultimately to pull it under that framework.
Of course, talk of the EU's next move becomes academic if the TPP itself isn't signed off by the Pacific countries now locked in negotiations. And there is growing political dissent in Asia, with arguments ranging from the price of medicine to the loss of national sovereignty. However, Assistant Secretary Russell says success is now within reach, and he has urged Pacific leaders to campaign for the TPP's adoption.
It's at the very last stage of the of any trade negotiation when the toughest issues are engaged on and the sort of darkest clouds seem to loom heavy. But every country and every leader that has embarked on these negotiations has done so in the conviction that they and the region stand to gain significantly from this high-quality, inclusive agreement. And I believe that every member of the negotiations is in it to see it through.
And with that, we've come to the end of this edition of Focus Asia Pacific from PCJ Radio International. If you'd like to let us know what you think of the program, we'd love to hear from you. Our email address is very simple, focus@pcjmedia.com. That's focus@pcjmedia.com. You can also download this edition of the program and past editions by visiting our website www.pcjmedia.com/FAP. That's www.pcjmedia.com/FAP. I should also tell you, by the way, that if there's a radio station that you know of that you would like to hear this program on air, do let us know or do let that local station know, and we'll see what we can do. Currently, the program is airing on over 30 radio stations worldwide, and, of course, at any time, anywhere, we're always looking to add others. So do let us know. Anyway, that's it. That's all we have time for. I'm Keith Pellow wishing you well. We'll see you again in 7 days' time. Until next time, so long and take care.